It's 9 o'clock. So today I want to talk about some of the topological aspects of abelian anomalies. And the short story is that there is indeed a topological character and significance to abelian anomalies, and the long story is what we want to unpack in the next couple of sessions. So it starts from the observation that the divergence, this could be the number of flavors, there's some coupling g squared, and there's an 8 pi squared. From the path integral perspective and the diagram perspective, we got this result. And this I is the Euclidean space formulation of this thing. So this can be written, as some of you pointed out already in earlier classes, as a total divergence of that thing. And here the symmetry, just to remind you of an abelian anomaly, is that psi is e to the I theta, psi prime, my primes are hard to see, psi prime is e to the I theta gamma 5 times psi. Whereas a non-abelian anomaly, this parameter would be dotted into a gauge generator. But A is a non-abelian gauge field. A mu is shorthand notation for A T A. So if the field is abelian itself, then this term goes away and you just have that. That's the simplest kind of anomaly from QED. But in general, the abelian anomaly for a set of non-abelian gauge fields is given by this. So what makes the anomaly abelian is the fact there's no generators up here. We'll look at the non-abelian aspect of this next time. All right, so I understand some of you last week took a look at differential forms, but the language for better understanding this topological character is indeed that of differential forms. And we will see that this thing becomes, in that language, D star of J5 is ING squared over 8 pi squared times the trace of F wedge F, sometimes written as IN, well, I'm sometimes going to drop that and just put F squared, as we will see. So let's unpack what that means. Now, how familiar are you with differential forms? Low, medium, high? Zero?
I think medium.
Medium? Okay, so I'll try and do a quick review of those. This language is very convenient for dealing with anti-symmetric tensor fields, and in general for gauge fields, because they involve curls of potential forms. So what a differential form is simply a zero form, is simply a function. And a one form you can get from that is df dx mu dx mu, or more generally, some four vector dotted into a quantity we call dx, a small change, or a basic differential element. So D is regarded as an operator, and that operator basically takes derivatives of quantities and contracts them with these form basis elements. Dx mu is a form basis element, or what else could I say it is? It's a differential element of distance in the space. In other words, it's just a small change in one of the coordinates. Yeah.
Just to clarify, by d star, you mean d times the Hodge dual?
Yeah, I'll get to that. I'll get to that. That's a preview for what's going to happen. But the star will refer to Hodge dual, as we will see. And if you haven't heard of a Hodge dual, you will shortly. So a general one form is like this. All derivatives of zero forms are one forms, but not all one forms are derivatives of zero forms. So now we could act on this again. We would get dA would be d of a mu dx mu, and the defining characteristic of the D operator is that it's nilpotent. If you act with it twice, you get nothing. So this would be equal to D of each of the components times dx mu plus a mu of D squared of x mu. That goes to zero by definition. Each component can be regarded as a function. So we would use the zero form language. So we would get dA mu dx nu times dx nu dx mu. And it is common to put a wedge in there. And that wedge means to anti-symmetrize. So the wedge notation was developed to remind people to anti-symmetrize. So this thing is really a mu comma nu minus a nu comma mu, where comma means partial derivative. And I guess there's a factor of two there. So we have dx mu wedge dx nu. Dx nu wedge dx mu, I think. And the other rule about these differential form operators, because they're anti-symmetric, we get a minus sign when we switch their places. That's the definition of anti-symmetry. You flip the thing around and you get the negative of what you had before. So is this familiar territory for most of you? Okay. So this is the curl of A. dA is basically a compact way of writing the curl. And if you have a P form, phi, let's say, is 1 over P factorial, phi mu 1 to mu P, dx mu 1 wedge dx mu p. Well, We tend to get tired of writing this, all those wedge things, they become redundant. So if we can drop the wedges if we remember that the dx's are automatically anti-symmetric. And if you're careful, the wedge notation really is redundant notation. So d phi will then be 1 over p factorial d nu, acting on all those phi things, times dx nu, dx mu 1, blah, 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 dx mu p, like so. And this, of course, is a more compact way of just writing the anti-symmetrization of all of those indices. So that's the curl of the P form. You take the derivative and anti-symmetrize over all the possibilities. When you have a one form, of course, you just have two possibilities. So suppose alpha is, let's say, a P form, and beta is a Q form, then alpha beta, of course, would be 1 over p factorial of this, and beta would be 1 over q factorial, beta nu 1 to nu q, dx nu 1, dx nu q. And that is negative 1 to the pq beta alpha. And you can see that because if I want to pull all this stuff over here, this dx has to go through p of those. The next dx has to go through p of those. So every time a dx goes through one of these, I get a minus sign. So the first dx gives me minus 1 to the p. The next dx gives me minus 1 to the p. I have q dx's, so I'm going to have minus 1 to the p q times. And so I get a negative 1 to the pq. So basically, an even form it's the odd-even thing. Even with even doesn't switch. Even with odd should be odd. Let's see, if p is even and q is odd, if either of p or q are even, then you get plus. But if both of them are odd, you get minus. That's the way I should say it. All right. So gauge fields are both forms and matrices. A is equal to A mu A TA DX mu. It's a form, it's a one form and a matrix because it's contracted into the generator as well. So now when we have differential gauge forms, we have to worry not only about these things and how they anti-commute, but also the T's. So the field strength, but that's actually a good thing because that means it's easy to write the field strength like this. This just turns out to be 1 half d mu a nu minus d nu a mu plus I a mu commuted with a nu. So this is what I will call a mu. If you don't see an upper Latin index on it, it means it's contracted with a T. So I would get,
and I think. Where does the I come from?
Yeah, where does the I? I think you need an IA squared there. And let's see. So this will be dx mu times dx nu. Or this would be a half d d mu a nu a minus I d mu a nu plus I f a b c times a b mu a c nu times all times t a dx mu dx nu, or I would write this as a half f a mu times that. So this is a Lie algebra valued, oh, I can't do it with my hands. This is a Lie algebra valued 2 form. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think the first two lines should have I's.
Is that right?
I think the third line, the I comes from the structure.
Yes, you're right. That is an error. I was getting ahead of myself and reading the lines. That's true, but that's there. So what I'm using is TA, TB is I, F, A, B, C. TA, TB. TA, let's do it this way. TB, TC is I, and I'll put all these up here, I guess. F, A, B, C times TA. Yeah. Thanks for pointing that out. Okay. So the field strength is both a 2 form and a Lie algebra valued object in general. Of course, if it's an abelian theory, the structure constants all vanish and we just have one A, or maybe a set of A's that all commute, but that's just a product of U1s. So DF is going to be D of DA plus A squared, which is D squared A plus DAA minus ADA, because I have to pull the D through the form. And let's see. So that's going to be 0. And this is going to be, if I write this, this is F minus A squared A minus A times F minus A squared, because that's what DA is. So I'll get minus A cubed plus A cubed. So those terms cancel. And what I'm left with is F, the commutator of F with A. And so I obtain what is called the Bianchi identity, that DF, which is defined as this derivative is 0. And that's what we call the Bianchi identity. You can do it by brute force in terms of taking the partial derivative and then anti-symmetrizing over all the indices, and you'll come up with the same kind of thing. But the nice thing about the form language is it's done in a few lines. Okay, so another operator that's useful is the Hodge dual, which obviously some of you are already familiar with. So if phi is a P form, which is written somewhere up over there, so if I take that same phi, then the dual of phi is defined to be 1 over n minus p factorial times So in n dimensions, the dual of phi basically is given by contracting on the components of phi with the n-dimensional epsilon and then contracting what's left over with the dx's. Yes.
Are you working in a flat space time?
At this point, yeah. Yeah, that's right. In a curved space time, you'd have the square root of the determinant of g coming in here, and you can do that, but the logic all flows the same. So basically, star maps p forms into n minus p forms. So it would take a zero form and map it into an n form. It would take a one form and map it into an n minus one form, and so on in n dimensions. In four dimensions, this is becomes very important because the electromagnetic field strength and the Yang-Mills field strength are two forms, and the Hodge dual maps them also into two forms. And you can obtain interesting results if you require that the field strength is self-dual, that a field strength is equal to its Hodge dual, and you end up getting interesting structures, but that's a story for another time. So the use of star is that allows us to take divergences. In form language. That's one of, it's not the only use, but it's one of the uses. So D of the star of A, suppose A is a, let me rub that out. Suppose A is a one form, then D of the star of A is going to be D of 1 over n minus 1 factorial with epsilon, let's say nu, and then nu 1 to nu n minus 1. Or maybe I'll write it mu 2 to mu n, I suppose, of a nu times d mu x mu 2 to dx mu n. So the D operator doesn't hit the epsilon. The epsilon's an invariant tensor. It's constant in the flat space. So what we've got is the only thing it can act on is A. So I'll have A nu comma lambda times 1 over n minus 1 factorial epsilon nu mu 2 to mu n times dx lambda dx mu 2 to dx mu n. And now we have this property that this is an n index anti-symmetric tensor. Or object, I guess I should call it. So there are n indices here, and it's fully anti-symmetric, so therefore it's proportional to the epsilon tensor. That's the only possible tensor structure it can be, and it's got to be multiplied by something. Well, the only possibility is dx mu, let me call it this way, dx alpha 1 to dx alpha n, or maybe I should say dx 1, dx 2, all the way up to dx n. In fact, you can show that it's equal to that. And so you've got a contraction of epsilon with this epsilon, and this contracted with that gives me a delta lambda nu times, well, I've still got this 1 over n minus 1 factorial, but there will be actually, there's a 1, if I work this out, this is dx1 to dxn, but I can write this more pleasantly or prettily or whatever you want to call it as 1 over n factorial epsilon mu 1 to mu n of dx mu 1 to dx mu n. In other words, if I contract this with an epsilon tensor, I get all the possibilities, and that gives me another 1 over n, which changes that into a 1 over n factorial, I think.
That equality sign, should there be a factor of n factorial there?
Should there be a factor of n factorial? Let me think.
There's a lot of terms.
The answer works out to be this, so it's a matter of whether I've got factorials in the intermediate step right. If it's n factorial, I'll get a factor of n here, but then when this is rearranged, I'm worried I'm going to get an n minus 1. I need an n factorial there. But you're right, I don't think it's just equal. It's equal to...
You've got a lot more terms on the left-hand side than the right-hand side.
Yes.
So there should be an n factorial also.
You think there should be an n factorial here?
Yeah.
Which would put an n factorial here, but I need to get this thing here, can't give me more than a 1 over n factorial. So I think, a little worried that it's actually, but when they are contracted, I get another 1 over n. When this contracts with this, I get another 1 over n factorial. That actually goes away. So in other words, what I'm using, that's where it comes from. So what I'm using, I think, is that epsilon mu alpha 1 to alpha n times epsilon nu alpha 1 to alpha n is delta mu nu, but there's a 1 over n factorial, I think, that does that. And then that cancels. That cancels this n factorial. And then I think what happens is that goes to that.
No, I think there's a n minus 1 factorial in the identity you just wrote down.
Because you're
contracting n minus 1 indices.
Oh, you're right. So this is here, n minus 1. So that'll leave me with an n over n minus 1 factorial. But then I've got to get an n factorial here. I've lost sight of myself on the blackboard.
I think that 1 over n minus factorial is in the numerator, which will then cancel the n minus 1 factorial that you'll
have. Oh, sorry, you're saying it's in the numerator?
Probably. That'll cancel the n minus 1
factorial. That'll cancel that. But then if that's true, I've got too many factorial things left over here.
Well, I think that first equation, that you're, I don't think you have an n factorial, the epsilon. There's no n factorial.
Well, that's what I thought originally. So it's the contraction.
It's
the contraction that will give me an n minus 1 factorial, and they cancel, and then this goes to that.
That's right.
Sorry about that. It's difficult. I skipped a step here to get to the final answer, so I couldn't remember where the factorials go. So star A, D of star A is that. So star D star A is just, now we're back to a zero form, which would just be D mu A mu. So in other words, this is the divergence operator, sometimes called curly D. and its function is to take divergences. So we have d squared equals 0, and we'll have curly d squared equals 0, and we'll have star squared is equal to, in Euclidean space, I think it's always 1. I think you have to watch the signs when you're not in Euclidean space. So now we get back to what we had over there. D mu j mu 5 has to be star of d star of j 5. In fact, let me do this separately over here. So if I write j 5 as j 5 mu dx mu, then d mu j mu 5 is equal to star d star of j 5. But we know that is equal to I times nf over 8 pi squared times the trace of f mu nu f dual mu nu.
Quick question. So we have curly d is star d star, and we showed it just for 1 forms. Is that definition also true for for n forms?
Well, for n forms, you would have
p
to.
Forms, sorry.
Pardon me?
So I meant for p forms. Like for any arbitrary form.
Yeah, for any arbitrary form, you can act on this and then take its dual. And then what it will do is take the divergence on one of the indices. But since the thing is anti-symmetrized, that's good enough. So yeah, it basically, for higher forms, it will take, it'll contract the partial derivative operator on one of the indices of the P form. So the P form, so if you take D of this thing, you'll get a derivative on that that is not one of these indices. And then when you take the star again, you'll get these epsilons contracting such that the free index derivative on here contracts on one of those. So you'll get something like d mu 1, phi mu 1, and all the rest will be left over contracted with stuff. Times maybe a numerical factor, but that's basically what it will do. So now, if I take the dual of both sides, then this is I nf g squared over 8 pi squared times the dual of the trace of this thing. But this thing is a zero form. So it is equal to, the trace of f mu nu f dual mu nu times epsilon alpha beta gamma delta dx alpha dx beta dx gamma oopsie daisy dx delta. But there's an epsilon hiding in here because f dual is equal to that. And in order for this to be right, since it's a zero form, I've got a 1 over 4 factorial in front of this structure by the definition of the form. And what that then does, when you multiply the epsilon in here, maybe I'll write it down so you'll remember, f dual mu nu is a half epsilon mu nu alpha beta f alpha beta. So when I, this epsilon multiplied by that epsilon gives you a product of Kronecker deltas, yes.
So you're using the tilde to denote the, basically the Hodge. So I mean,
well,
f mu nu, f tilde mu nu, isn't it a 4 form? Not a 0 form?
No, it's a 0 form because these are all indices that are contracted. So I'm going originally from index language. This is not yet written as a form. That's where we're going. Right now, this is a two-indexed object whose definition is that.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Okay. So this is f mu nu f alpha beta times that epsilon.
Sure.
I'll have to use different indices. So the point is this epsilon and this epsilon multiply together. So I've got epsilon mu nu alpha beta epsilon rho sigma lambda tau is delta mu rho delta nu sigma delta alpha lambda delta beta tau, but anti-symmetrized over all the possibilities. So the net effect of all those Kronecker deltas is to get d star of J5. So you've got a bunch of Kronecker deltas acting on the Fs and on the Ds. So the net effect of this is that this equals I NFG squared over 8 pi squared times a factor of 2 times the trace, because there's a gauge trace in there, of f mu nu dx mu dx nu times f alpha beta dx alpha dx beta. So now we recover the two forms. And if I use, well, let me write down the answer and then tell you the definition. It's 2i nfg squared over 8 pi squared times the trace of f squared, where f is defined as a half f alpha beta dx alpha dx beta. So in other words, in form language, we're getting that J, D of star J, is equal to, so let me just write it down. Then D of star J5 is INF over G squared, there's a 4 pi squared, times the trace of the square of F. This is always a bit, at least in my opinion, a little bit confusing, that in form language, F squared, is FF dual, because you've got F times a bunch of D's, and the bunch of D's give you an epsilon. So F squared becomes FF dual. F squared in form language is F mu nu, F dual mu nu, up to some factor. And that just follows from those definitions. So the other thing we need to get anywhere is Stokes' theorem to draw some interesting relationships. And this just says the integral of a form over a boundary is the integral of D of the form over the manifold it contains. So this is some p-dimensional, well, maybe I'll write it over here. M is some p-dimensional surface or volume, say, p-dimensional surface. Dm is the boundary of M. And beta is a p minus 1 form. So the classic example of this is ds mu nu of f mu nu is equal to the integral over a closed loop of the gauge potential, where this is some surface. I have some surface f here, and I have some curve surrounding it. So the integral of the field strength through this surface is equal to the line integral of the gauge potential around the thing that bounds the surface. So if this surface can be pulled out, stretched, molded, but as long as C is that boundary, that theorem is going to hold. I actually was told that Stokes' theorem first appeared as a question on a final exam in 1854 in Cambridge. See if the students could figure out how to answer it. Probably a tad nasty on the part of
the only student who could figure it out was Maxwell.
Sorry?
Apparently the only student who could figure it out was Maxwell.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so so that's something that we would use later in form language. This relation becomes the integral of f over m is equal to the integral of a over dm. So that's a two form, that's a one form, and if I integrate f over some two-dimensional surface, I get the integral of A over the boundary of that surface. All right, so how many of you have familiarity or have heard of cohomology? One, maybe a couple. Not much. Okay. So we're not going to go into something highly sophisticated here, but you need at least to be aware of what this is. The cohomology problem is the following. What are the non-trivial solutions to d alpha equals 0 if alpha is a p-form? This is a bit of a digression, but we'll get back to the other. So suppose I have a p-form, and I take d of it, and I get nothing. What possible p-forms satisfy this relationship? Now, there's an obvious one, that if alpha is d of something else, clearly it's a solution. But that's regarded as a trivial solution. Anybody could get that solution. So we want all the solutions, so non-trivial, alpha is not d of something, but d alpha is 0. So the cohomology problem is basically the problem of finding all possible solutions to this equation that are not of this type. So if suppose two forms are related by this kind of thing. Suppose I have two different p forms and they're equal except for the fact that there's a d of a p minus 1 form here. Then clearly the d's are the same. So if d alpha 1 equals 0, then d alpha 2 equals 0, obviously. So what one does is we want, the problem is to find all the solutions to d alpha equals 0 up to this kind of equivalence, up to, let me just call this, up to that equivalence. I don't want to write the equation again. Equivalence. So that is the cohomology problem, as stated mathematically. And the number of inequivalent solutions. For a P form on a given manifold is called the Pth Betti number. And the Betti number is a topological invariant. I'm really squeezing the board here. I'll write it here. This is a topological invariant. So one manifold might have a Betti number of 2. Another manifold might have a Betti number of 27. So the manifold characterizes the possible inequivalent solutions you can have to that kind of equation.
Are we assuming the manifolds are compact?
In general, yes. Yeah. So, they could have boundary. It depends. You can solve the problem in different contexts. But it's common for the manifolds to be assumed compact. So I've lost my place here.
It could be non-compact without a boundary.
Yeah, in which case then it's not clear how to solve the problem entirely. So if the manifold is non-compact without boundary, it's not clear there is always a solution because it depends on what kind of manifold you've got. And if it's non-compact without boundary, then you may not be able to do it. So related to this, that gets us back to where we were, is something called, or that will help us get back to the issue of gauge fields and anomalies, is something called the Poincaré lemma, is for any region R that is deformable to a point in some manifold M, then if d alpha equals 0 in this region, then alpha is equal to d beta in that same region. So in other words, this solution to the cohomology problem cares about the connectedness of the manifold. And if you look at a small patch, you can shrink a small patch to 0 continuously. And this lemma says the only solutions to this equation in a patch that can be shrunk are what we call exact forms. In other words, trivial solutions. And maybe I should use the other language. If d alpha equals 0, this is what we call a closed form. So closed means D is 0. Exact means it's the D of something. So all exact forms are closed. Not all closed forms are exact. But if you're in a contractible region, then all closed forms are exact. So what you can have, of course, is you can solve this equation. Suppose you have a manifold that's like a donut. That's not simply connected. You can take a patch, get a solution like this on a patch, take another patch, get a solution like this on another patch, but they will fit together non-trivially. They will not be, there will be a non-trivial way of putting the solutions together. So that's basically what's done here. Suppose I have a sphere and I cover the northern hemisphere plus a little bit more with something, and then I take the southern hemisphere and I cover it differently. Well, over here, I'll get one solution in the south. In the north, I'll get another solution. But where they match will tell me whether or not I actually have a non-trivial solution to the cohomology problem. So I've got d alpha equals 0. And up here, alpha is equal to d beta 1 in the north. And down here, alpha is equal to d beta 2 in the south. And beta 1 equals beta 2 plus d sigma. Perhaps on the overlap, in which case I would have a trivial solution, but sometimes not. So let's do an example here. Suppose alpha, let's say M, is equal to the plane minus the origin. So it's equal to R2 minus the origin. So it's like a gigantic plane, but there's a hole right in the center. So, and alpha, let's let alpha equal minus y over x squared plus y squared dx plus x over x squared plus y squared dy. Then you can show that d alpha is equal to 0. I won't do that here because it's not hard to do, but it's very straightforward to do. But alpha is not defined at x equals y equals 0. So that's why, that's okay, because we've subtracted off, maybe I should say not but note. It's not defined there, that's okay, because that point is not in the manifold. So locally, in any finite patch, alpha has to be the d of something, and that something is the arctan of y divided by x. So d of the arctan of y divided by x just turns out to be equal to that. It's easy to calculate. So it looks like alpha is equal to d beta everywhere, but in fact it is not. It's actually single-valued. I guess I'll have to pull this back down again. Alpha is actually single valued on only a finite part of the manifold. And in fact, if you draw this thing, there's actually a cut you can make right here along this axis. So alpha equals d beta everywhere here, but not along this axis. In other words, we leave out that part of the axis. So this whole region is deformable to a point. If I leave out this part of the plane, I can pull all of this around and squash it into a point. So Poincaré's lemma is satisfied there. So is there some other beta prime such that alpha equals d beta prime on all of R2 minus the origin. And the answer, well, if there were, then beta would equal, a beta prime would equal beta plus a constant. That would be the only possible solution if we had that. So if beta is only defined on there, then so is beta prime. And the answer is you can't, there isn't any other function that would work everywhere. You could define one that doesn't work here, and then you'd have the other patch contractible. But the only possible solution is to add a constant to beta. And so this this does not work. So alpha actually is a closed form, but it is not exact. You'd have to calculate alpha in one patch where you'd get the arctan, and on a different patch where you could get another arctan, but they would have to be non-trivially related to each other. I want to get back to the gauge field thing. So, all right, I'm not going to finish all of the gauge field thing. This is the technology we need to get that far. Basically, the trick that is going to be used is the following. Let's define. So I'll do the general thing, and then we'll have to stop. In general, x mu let's define some function of the coordinates so that x mu of 1, x, is equal to x mu, and x mu of 0, x, is equal to y mu. So I'm imagining there is some kind of curve. Lambda is in the region 0 to 1, so defined. I'm imagining there is some kind of curve such that when lambda is 0, this point is at y, and when lambda is 1, this point is at x. So this is lambda equals 0, this is lambda equals 1. And 1 and x is continuous. So you can find a general solution to this Poincaré lemma equation. If we write alpha, the differential form, as alpha of x1 minus alpha of x0, this is equal to the integral from 0 to 1 of delta alpha delta lambda d lambda. And so the solution d alpha equals 0 implies that this is true locally. When you write out the answer, you get, using this kind of approach, you get beta is p plus 1, the integral from, times the integral from 0 to 1 of dx tau d lambda. I've got some lines of arithmetic to show it, but it's 10 o'clock, so I'll just write down the answer of capital X times dx nu 1, dx mu 1, dx nu p, dx mu p, d lambda multiplied by this differential form, dx mu 1 to dx mu p. So in other words, the general solution to the Poincaré lemma is this function right here explicitly. So you invent some function capital X that depends on both the manifold point and on this parameter lambda, and you find if you want to solve this equation, if you want to solve this equation, the local solution is always given by this. You basically integrate the form as a function of this capital X and multiply by all of these dx, well, this by dx by d lambda and the rest by d capital X by d little x, and you get that answer. This is going to be used for gauge fields. I'm already over time, so I better stop. For gauge fields, this looks a lot more complicated than it actually turns out to be. For a gauge field, we're going to write A of X is going to be lambda A mu, or lambda times A of X. In other words, lambda A mu dx mu. So the way this will work, what we're going to do next time is solve Poincaré's lemma for the case of gauge fields. And what we're going to do in this assumption is take the simplest thing we can, namely, we're just going to say we're going to choose some gauge field as a function of lambda such that it's proportional to lambda. So when lambda's 0, we have no gauge field. When lambda's 1, we have the original gauge field. And that will allow us to basically to integrate the anomaly equation and get an explicit form for what it means and give it a topological interpretation. And I didn't get to that today, so I'll have to leave that for next time. But that's where all this stuff is going. Okay, so I guess we better stop. Sorry, I went a few minutes over. Unless there's other, yeah.
The simple example that you gave, is there a physical application of that example? Or?
Not off the top of my head. One application that's going to come in for gauge theories is magnetic monopoles.
But that's
we're not there yet. But basically, for a magnetic monopole, you'll get a gauge field such that you can give a definition of a gauge field that's defined everywhere in the south, a different definition that's defined everywhere in the north. On the equator, the two are related by a gauge transformation, but they are not equivalent to one another. The one at the bottom has a singularity here. The one on the top has a singularity there, but you never see the singularity because you never, in the top and bottom places, you never actually have the gauge field cover the entire range. And it turns out that that offers the interpretation of a magnetic monopole, and what it means is the magnetic monopole is actually a topological object, and from that you can infer things like the electric charge times the magnetic charge is some integer multiple of 2 pi and all this kind of thing. So that's where this is going, and I'm sorry I didn't quite get there, but next time we'll use this technology in this way to get some answers for anomalies, and then later on next week to understand monopoles. Okay.